Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, one of the things that we know is that there are many, many Americans, and the number that we seem to be using now is around 47 million. 47 million Americans that don't have health insurance, or perhaps what they do have is just not adequate to their needs. We will be talking this morning about something that is connected in many ways, but a little bit different. And that is the fact that there are probably millions more, even more than that 47 million, who have little or no mental health coverage. Our guest in this part of the show is Christopher Larrison. He is assistant professor of social work at the University of Illinois. And we're talking a bit about the need for mental health services, what is available, and also we'll be talking about the idea of community-based mental health and how that has evolved over the past few decades, and perhaps also how it might be made more inclusive and easier for people to use. And questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, David. It's really a privilege.
Do we have some sort of an idea of, in any given year, how many people experience an episode of severe psychological distress? And I'm sure that psychologists and social workers have some way of defining what exactly that means and where the line is between something that might require serious intervention and something perhaps less serious. But if you try to look at the people who are hurting the most, any idea about how many people we're talking about?
Boy, that's a difficult question. We know at a point in time about 20% of people in the country are likely to experience some kind of mental health problem. And severity here is really a huge range from light depression to sort of what you're starting to describe, which would be somebody that was in desperate need of services. So the actual percentage of people looking for services is very difficult to tell. We know about 50% of people who need services in any given year out of that 20% are not receiving the services that they need for a variety of reasons. Either they can't find them, or they don't know about their existence, or they don't have access to them because of cost problems.
Yeah. Well, that really is the important question, and there was where I was heading to try to – do we actually have some idea of how many people really need help now, and whether that is that they would just benefit by having a few sessions of counseling, or we have people who are in severe distress. Maybe in a sense it doesn't matter. The question is how many of those people actually do manage to find the help that they need, and it sounds like maybe about half?
Yeah, about 50% of them are finding the help that they need. Yeah.
When you look at the reasons, and you said there could be a number of reasons, it could simply be that they were in a place where it's just not available. It could be that their services are there, but they're not really sure where they are, how to get them. And then there also is the case that there's a matter of cost and they simply can't afford it. If you sort out among those options, I guess particularly the places where people would say there simply aren't any services at all, or the issue is it's there, but that they can't afford it.
Yeah, it's really this county. So about 45% of the counties in the United States have access to a community mental health center, which means that you have pretty localized access to decent community mental health care. And anybody that falls into a situation where they're severely mentally ill, they're experiencing a severe mental illness, they often will receive, fall into a Social Security kind of situation where they will receive a disability payment and they will have access of services through Medicaid or Medicare. Mm-hmm. And so the people in the worst possible, having the worst possible experiences, we do serve in some way. And part of their problem is really a very fragmented system then, and how do, even though you have access to care and you have presumably the resources to use that care, it still remains a very fragmented system that it doesn't provide the kind of holistic care that people with severe mental illness need. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about people who are experiencing something different, maybe a depression kind of situation that doesn't preclude you from working, doesn't preclude you from interacting with your family, but it is a chronic and ongoing problem that is affecting your life and the quality of your life on a regular basis. And let's say that you work in a situation where you don't have any health care.
Yeah, no health insurance. So what does a person like that do?
Well, the community mental health clinics are required, or they really are. Part of their mission is to serve people in the community regardless of need. The problem is the money that has flowed from the federal government and from the state government to make it possible for agencies to provide people services that don't have an ability to pay has dried up over the years. And so it will become very difficult. There'll be long waiting lists for that person if the service is even available in their community. Some communities, we've seen, for instance, clinical services dry up entirely. And part of this has been driven a little bit by a focus on severe mental illness, and which is a good focus. We've tried to focus services and money on people who are experiencing the most severe problems. The problem is that really doesn't represent the whole pie. Mm-hmm. And that we're missing a lot of people and that desperately need services but are not severely mentally ill.
I wonder, too, for those people who are fortunate enough to have health insurance where there is some kind of mental health benefit or protection offered, whether, in fact, for those people what is offered is adequate. They may have some kind of benefit, but that it could be quite limited. And so it could be that they would say, well, we will cover you for 6 sessions of counseling. And then we'll cover you for medication, and then that's that. And that's helpful. I suppose that's better than nothing. But for a lot of people, that's really not a very good way of taking care of the them and what they need.
No, we really see that long-term care and not care that goes on forever, because that's unrealistic too, but at least some engagement with people when they are being medicated and providing some face-to-face services is important. And you can imagine in our situation here at the university, we have some limitation on the number of sessions that we can seek out in any given year and a lifetime total that is easily sucked up if mm-hmm. you have a problem. And in fact, in New York State, which just passed parity, a couple drove that particular law and the passage of that law in New York State because of just that situation. They got to the 12th session, and their son had used up their 12th session. And after that 12th session, their son continued to present suicidal. And they said, please, can you see us? And they said, well, you've run out of your insurance, and if you can pay for it, you can come in. And they said, no, we can't. And within a week, their son, and this is an extreme case, committed suicide. So we hope that doesn't happen that often, but you can imagine how frustrating it is if you're in the midst of treatment and you're going to continue to receive medication, and in the midst of treatment you have to decide, can I pay for this out of pocket, which can run at a private practitioner anywhere from $60 to $120 an hour. And if you're going an hour a week, right, that adds up pretty quickly in terms of out-of-pocket costs.
Let me give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the concept of community mental health, because this takes us back to the point, this would have been in, I guess, in the 1960s, when probably for most people, particularly if they were suffering severe psychological distress, the place they would be getting their treatment is in some kind of large state-run institution. Not for a number of reasons, not ideal. And with the best of intentions, we said it would really be better if we could provide for a kind of a community-based institution so that people could get care near where they lived, their family could visit them, that for, you know, you could have outpatient services available right there. For a lot of reasons, this made much more sense. And everybody said, well, yeah, sure, that's great. The problem is that it really didn't work out to the fullness that we would really like. There certainly are places that there are community mental health centers, and they do provide those services. But somehow, why didn't it work out to be what we had hoped for and what we said we wanted to do at the beginning?
There's been a lot of reasons. And I think we have to look at maybe the whole history of mental health, the policy. And that really starts as early as the 1780s in England, where we see the development of the asylum. And in France, we see the introduction of what's called moral treatment by a guy named Pinel. And he really just takes all the history previous to this and reconfigures it and comes out and says, listen, you really have to just provide a basic milieu, an environment that's therapeutic in nature. And from there, we can add treatments. And this was the beginning of the asylum period. And really, what we often think about as a country is when, by the 60s, right, one flew over the cuckoo's nest, 550,000 people in institutions, little treatment being provided, and a decision in 63 by the federal government to make a massive switch in terms of policy from the asylum and the institution to community-based services. And really, from 63 until 80, we see two important pieces going side by side that are really building community mental health up. And that is the federal government, in terms of funding, is continuing to build the kinds of services that they're willing to fund right out of the federal budget. So we start off with adult mental health services, and we add children's services, and we see developmental disabilities, and we see the addition of drug and alcohol services over time. And then the other piece that's going on in the background is the court system is continuing to dismantle the institutions through the process of focusing on the need for treatment and the right to treatment for people who are seeking treatment. And so we see this crash, and then in the 1980s, we're now by 1980, the system is disassembled, and community mental health is up and running. And suddenly, in 1979, the last thing Jimmy Carter did was to reaffirm the federal government's commitment to mental health. With the election of Ronald Reagan, we started the block granting of mental health money. And with the block granting of mental health money, we saw an ever-decreasing commitment to community mental health. That decreasing commitment meant that this system that had been built up over 20 years to provide a huge amount of services to anybody that came into their door was now having a retraction of funding that was going to be very difficult to continue to provide those services. And that's what we've seen since the mid-80s till now, is that community mental health agencies hear from the state government that every year there's going to be a cut or there's going to be just stasis. This year there was no increase, no decrease. But the expectation is that you're going to continue to provide services. And the way community mental health works is that they are set up and they provide what's called services to a catchment area, which is a geographically defined area. And anybody within that area that meets the DSM qualifications for having a mental health disorder is welcome to access services.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, just looking at the state of Illinois, though, can you say that there are places where the people just don't have services, or the center that's supposed to provide them services is far enough away so that the idea of going there for treatment is difficult, if not impossible?
Yeah, that was the third part that we never really talked about. You can imagine, even in places, and I do a bunch of work in southern Illinois and in Kentucky and Arkansas and Missouri and a whole bunch of places, rural Georgia. And even when there's a mental health center in the county, often these counties, think of Georgia, think of here, big states, big counties, that's a centrally located place, and if you don't have transportation or access to transportation, it's very difficult to get to those services. And then you can imagine, in terms of severe mental illness, it's not just about the receipt of your medication and 1 hour of counseling. In fact, very few people receive 1 hour counseling in that situation. It's really about an array of services that focus on the development of social skills and the providing of a nice, stable environment from which we can hopefully work to decrease your symptomology and increase mm-hmm. your productivity and your interaction with the community around you. And you can imagine if you're separated way out into a rural area, it will be very difficult then to have that kind of access and interaction.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Christopher Larrison, he is Assistant Professor of Social Work at the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the availability of mental health services here in the United States and also concentrating on the status of community mental health in this country, what that concept was all about, what the idea was at the beginning when that movement got going, sort of where we are really now, and trying to give some attention to the problem of access to mental health care, which is, there are serious gaps. You know, depending on who you are, where you live, you may have access to good services, and there are other places where you simply don't. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We certainly now have a range of medications to help with psychological problems that a wide range of, in many cases, good, very helpful medications, certainly better than what we had in the past in terms of their effectiveness and lack of side effects and problems connected with them. At the same time, you have to say that while these things can be helpful, they are not necessarily a substitute for one-on-one counseling. It can be an adjunct to counseling. But I wonder if there are many cases where people may, in fact, be getting medication because a primary care doctor could prescribe that, but that they're not getting really much of anything else. And is that sufficient? Is that, in effect, just putting the proverbial Band-Aid on the problem? Is that a viable long-term solution to have someone taking medication for, in a sense, you know, who knows how long a person might be taking that medication?
Right. I don't think it's viable. There may be others that would argue that it is. We see, particularly at the, if we talk about schizophrenia and some of the new medications that have come out, for instance, to deal with that particular problem, the side effects of some of these medications are miserable. And we know that even though when we drive down symptomology using medication with people who are experiencing schizophrenia, that often when they start to feel better, they'll want to go off their medication because what they start to feel is not only better and is the side effects. And for instance, some of the drugs will have incredible weight gain over a 2 or 3 year period. And I'm not just talking 10 pounds or 20 pounds a year, where somebody could end up at the end of a 2 year period or 3 year period gaining 100 pounds. And we know from a health standpoint that that doesn't do anybody any good, but also just from your mental health standpoint, that kind of body change is often distressing to people. And particularly if it's a side effect of a medication, how do you balance these things out? I'm feeling better in terms of I'm not hearing voices, but my physical health and my well-being in terms of how I feel about myself is also going down. And I think that that's the case across the board, and we see this in depression. We know that there's been a lot of going back and re-examining the clinical trials around depression medications, particularly in the area of children, because we've seen in some cases that the medication has pushed the children for reasons that are unbeknownst to us at this point out to a point where they become more depressed and more suicidal. And this really seems to be a subgroup of people within children who have that experience. And you can imagine a situation where a primary care physician gives out a medication to somebody who is presenting depressed and does their regular follow-ups, but there is no mental health really intervention. It will be harder to find those kids and to then reverse treatment, approach it a different way. And we're really going to have to think hard what to do with that subgroup of people, for instance.
Yeah. Well, you were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that what has happened over time is that the amount of federal money that was available to fund community mental health has declined. The states haven't really been able to make up the gap. They certainly can't say, oh, well, that's fine. We'll write you a check for the difference. They're not able to do that. So that community mental health is in some places is probably struggling or probably just hanging on. I know that going back to, I think this was in 2001, the President Bush, launched a major presidential task force. Now, and I think that this was in the context of generally looking at services for and quality of life for people who are disabled, various kinds of disabilities. And under that, there was this presidential commission.
The new commission for mental health.
An amazing title, yes. And that this was launched, I believe it was in 2001.
2002 to 2003 was when the committee met.
They put out a big report and affirmed the fact that it's very important for these people to have service. They say we really need to deal with the stigma of mental illness so that people will feel they can't ask for services. And then we have to make sure that services are available and that they're appropriate for the person. You know, this big, long thing and people can read that on the web if they want to see it. That all looks really good. Has there actually been a commitment in terms of money coming along to back up this nice set of goals that they set out?
No, I think like all social programs, we've been crushed down by some other issues at the federal level. And it's hard to imagine in 2002 the excitement about the President Bush and really, you know, carrying through on this idea of compassion and conservatism and focusing on a group like people experiencing mental illness. It's hard to imagine that transpired. It's been long forgotten in many ways. The commission's report was very confirmatory of the many problems that we knew you in the progress that we have made and really reflected a lot of the things that we saw in an earlier report, the 1999 report out of the Surgeon General's office, and then which was also followed up by a 2001 report. And I guess the saddest part is that it's not that we haven't developed services or interventions that are successful with people and that do create positive and good outcomes. Those things have been created. There's been money spent on research that has really had very positive outcomes in terms of our understanding of what works with people experiencing mental health problems. It's really become a question now of the availability of those services on a local level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would expect that people who were involved in this commission had good intentions. I don't think that it was their idea that they would make a report and that that would just be an empty gesture. But then was it just the issue was that there were so many pressing demands for money and that we also had a war going on and a lot of other things, and it simply was the matter of there were other things that whether they had to take precedence or not, that's another question, but other things that took precedence, and there wasn't the money, or at least there wasn't more money than had been going into it before.
Absolutely. I think it's mental health is much like poverty, too. It is something that churns in the background and affects a fairly large portion of our population, which is hard to believe sometimes because it does churn very quietly in the background and affects people's lives in ways that are much more quiet and much less public than some of the other issues that have come to the forefront federally recently. And it makes it very hard. The advocacy around mental health is we have NAMI and GROW and some other consumer movements and APA and social work is all involved in this. But our voices are not as strong as some of the other voices lobbying for the interest and ear of people at the federal level. And even at the state level, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard. And we're in line with a lot of people. We're in line with education. We're in line with immigration. We're in line with poverty. We're in line with child welfare. All these are good issues. But the problem is that sometimes people tend to forget that mental health is a monstrous problem. When you're talking about 20% of our population having some kind of experience a mental health problem, It really brings it home. The World Health Organization sees unipolar depression as being the number one cause of disability around the world. And so when we drop to the bottom of the list all the time, it becomes very difficult for us to serve this very large and needy population of people.
Yeah, and I suppose that it's also, this has been one of those problems that's been kind of in the shadow of the healthcare policy debate, because we've certainly spent a lot of time talking about the problem of access to healthcare for all those people who don't have health insurance and can't go to the doctor when they need to. That gets an awful lot of attention. This part seems not to get as much, and it certainly deserves it. It's as big, if not a more serious problem. And I wonder whether that doesn't somehow reflect our general discomfort with mental illness. It's not an easy thing to talk about. We talk about it now more than we used to, but it's still not an easy thing to talk about. And there are probably still people who are not inclined to seek treatment because there is a stigma and they're not real keen on having people know that they're having psychological problems.
Absolutely. And that continues today. We have made great progress. And, one of the upshots of celebrity involvement is, for instance, depression has become a much more acceptable problem, one of which people are willing to talk about. But again, to take another problem, think about schizophrenia. And I asked students in my mental health policy class, how many people would want to claim that they were schizophrenic or had that history? The stigma is so deep here and then makes it very difficult for people to want to use services or find services or admit to having a problem with this. And then families experience the stigma as they go about trying to find services for their family member.
And I think this is maybe a different but, again, related problem that we do have this commitment, at least some commitment to personal autonomy, rights, privacy. And that it can also be difficult sometimes when maybe you have a family member who is in severe distress and you would think that person really needs, for perhaps for their own safety and the safety of other people, to be receiving treatment. And yet there's a certain point at which if that person has not done anything, you know that they have problems, and you know that perhaps if nothing changes, they might be a threat to themselves or other people. But until they actually do something, they cannot be compelled to go into treatment. As much as you might say, you know, this is my child, and I know that she really needs help, but she won't go, he won't go. And you can't, until something really bad happens, you can't make them.
No, and you can't. And in fact, if this person is over 18 years old, you don't even get access to their records unless they sign a release under HIPAA. And this creates a lot of problems. I think, Virginia Tech, and when you look at that scene, this is what we're talking about. The person there did receive services. They received, at the very highest end, they were remanded to a hospital against their will for 72 hours of evaluation, which in the setting today is very, you have to reach a certain level of presentation publicly in terms of symptomology to get to be involuntarily committed to the hospital for some observation. So that occurred. But once, they can't hold you. By law, they can't hold you for any longer than a certain period of time. Once you're released, what you're told is here is where you can go to contact mental health services, and they'll give you the name of a community mental health clinic. And the community mental health clinic will be also contacted, stating that you are being released from the hospital and that it's being requested that you seek services. Now, unless you've committed some criminal offense, there is nothing compelling you to go seek those services at the community mental health clinic. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And in the case of the Virginia Tech student, they would have had access to those services if they had wanted to get them.
Well, do you think that in order to provide for individuals' rights, the fact that we say to them, you have the right to choose. We always say the patient, unless we're dealing with an extreme case, patient always has the right to refuse treatment. That person has the right to their privacy. But then on the other side, we might say, but we really say that for that person's own good, for everybody's good, that person should be in treatment whether they want to or not. Have we made a bad trade-off, do you think, between the issue of need, what would in fact be best for that person, and our commitment to the idea of autonomy and privacy?
Boy, that's such a difficult question, David. To be honest with you, we are a society that is very focused on individual rights, and particularly if somebody hasn't done something to compel us to intervene and to take away those individual rights. And so I'm very hesitant to try to prejudge people with mental health disorders and to withdraw rights from them or to force them into treatment. And particularly given that the treatment may not always be available. But if it were, I'm still hesitant, because to compel people to do something because we believe that something might happen in the future is a very difficult process. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. The downside is, as you can see at the Virginia Tech, we kid ourselves if we don't think that mental health problems, severe mental health problems, lend themselves to people doing things that are incredibly unpredictable. They really do. In their most severe forms, they do things that are unpredictable. And then sometimes those unpredictable things are very violent. And it becomes very difficult in my mind how to get down to that subset of people readily and even then to predict the violence that might occur.
We have a couple of callers here to bring in the conversation. We're a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest is Christopher Larrison. He is assistant professor of social work at the University of Illinois. We're talking about mental health services in the United States, the problem of availability, and also we're talking in a general and also somewhat specific sense about mental health, community mental health in the United States and in its status, just what's there in terms of services and how they meet or sometimes don't meet the need. Questions are certainly welcome. We have several people here ready to go. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, join the conversation. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have some callers here. We'll start with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to raise two other points. When you talk about the social stigma of mental illness, another thing to take into consideration is that any indication of mental illness, particularly suicidal, depression kinds of things, on your medical record will disqualify you from getting life insurance policies. And you will also find that you won't be able to get many long-term care policies. And you can't even apply for those unless you let your medical records go free, become available. And I know that from people in my own family who might, when they were young and, of course, having adolescent depression, you know, 20 years later couldn't get any kind of insurance. So we have the insurance companies invading into that. And I think another point is that psychiatry and psychology really don't refuse to recognize that the pharmacological treatment of mental illness is not a science, that neuronal activity is very interrelated. We're all treating depression lately with SSRIs, and yet we don't know which particular SSRI will work on a particular individual, and we don't know how dopamine affects that activity. And so there's a bit of a witchcraft approach. So I don't think we should really, we need to recognize that, as with a lot of medicine, that we're not dealing with a science, we're dealing with, well, this can have a treatment. We don't know that if you give somebody something which will increase the serotonin level in their brain for a long time, might actually decrease the body's ability to create its own serotonin and lead to crippling effects long term. So I think we have a lot of issues to deal with, both in terms of making public knowledge of one's mental illness, and also I think that the whole concept of treatment, and again, that's controlled by insurance companies, which have forced people to go into basically treatment by pills rather than by conversation or any other means. There's a lot to be said about that issue, and of course, you need to have other people to talk to, but you might want to make some comments. Thank you.
Sure.
Absolutely. I think two wonderful points. First of all, we don't have a great understanding of how medications work. It is truly a black box for us. The medications are given out, and we know that they do decrease symptomology on the other side, and why that occurs, we are uncertain about at this point. Although I would say we hold out great hope. I mean, the breaking of the human genome, we are going to see an ever-increasing focus on what are the biological and genetic underpinnings to all of disease and all of health problems. And I think as we begin to understand mental health better through those eyes, and combine it up with the vast amount of knowledge that we have about the environment, that we will start to understand how medications are working and why they work for some people and why they don't work for others and why they make some people worse and why they make some people better. So an outstanding point there in terms of medication and the idea that we do operate with a black box kind of idea. We give people medication. We're not sure why it works. The other piece is about information, which from a researcher standpoint is very true also. We don't keep large data sets, large national data sets on mental health for a variety of good reasons around stigma. Confidentiality issues make it very difficult to do research within community mental health and mental health in general because of the stigma that's associated with admitting to having a mental health problem. And the insurance situation that the caller mentions is classic. There's a number of other events. If you were to admit to a mental health problem on an application to the Army, this will create large problems, even if it's a problem that was minor and went away. Okay, and we know for some people they will experience some minor mental health problem. They'll need some kind of services for it and never have another problem again. And all of a sudden on their record is a mental health problem that precludes you from, in the case they talked about in Virginia, from buying a gun. In this case, it's precluding you from buying long-term insurance. It may preclude you from certain jobs. So it really continues on.
Let's talk with someone else here. Champagne is next, line two. Hello.
Hi. The previous point I think should be emphasized about the lack of longitudinal studies on the SSRIs. It's absolutely outrageous that Eli Lilly can get away with that, it seems to me. But I actually wanted to call. You were talking earlier about the effect of the war on the budget, I would like to turn it around and look at the other aspects of the lack of compassionate conservatism, and that is the idea that particularly community mental health is most lacking, I guess, in the rural areas. We know that the rural areas are contributing a very disproportionately high percentage to the population. We have, in this area, evidence that the violence in Iraq is coming home to roost, as it were, because we've had a number of murders just in this region of returning vets. It's going. What I'm getting at is this: not only is this going to be adding to the budget. I mean, that's in some ways is the least of it. But it's going to stress the system in very very difficult ways. And I just think that we need to someone needs to be trying to get proactive on this and point. Try to get ahead of this because it's already, I think, been disastrous in its implications. I guess I'll hang up and listen on the air.
All right.
Absolutely. We know from the research, and the Army has said this as well, and all the military services, that the percentage of people returning with mental health problems from war zones is fairly high, and their need for services is fairly high. And we saw the disaster out in Colorado where servicemen were asking for services and then were promptly denied services, and not only denied services, but then drummed out of the service for behaviors that were bad behaviors, unquestionably, but previous to those behaviors had asked for help in some attempt to prevent them from occurring. So there is no question that the returning vets, and we're going to see an ever-increasing number of them, particularly in rural communities, are going to present difficult cases for, in some cases, going to present difficult cases for mental health providers.
All right, let's go to Urbana Line 3 for someone else. Right here, Line 3. Hello.
Hello. It's quite odd. The longer I listen to the show, the more things I want to say. I come from a family of childhood mental illness, like all the way through from the time you're quite young, including myself. And it's interesting when you talk about different things like trying to get people help, I've mostly heard you talking about adults. And having spent time in both the youth ward and the adult ward at the pavilion and seeing the difference, it's quite interesting. You go to the adult ward and actually most of the people check themselves in. There's a percentage, but it's much smaller, that are checked in by loved ones. When you go to the youth ward, I think I was the only one who checked myself in. Getting yourself help actually seems to happen more as an adult. And the other thing, oh God, what was I going to say, you're talking a lot about, well, there are these major cases of, like, schizophrenia that really turn into, like, cases where, you know, people go out and kill a bunch of people, and you keep on talking about these major cases, but I found watching the news and looking at things that a lot of the depression that a lot of these people have had would be what a lot of people would say minor, just normal depression, what a lot of people, and I mean a lot of people in our schools and families and society suffer from, like a very bipolar type 1 or even just major depressive disorder where they wouldn't have had depression, but enough people have harassed them. And so people kind of turn a blind eye, because it's not schizophrenia or serious depression where you've seen violence in them before. It just kind of pops up, which I think is even more dangerous. And then for my third and last comment, as far as medications go, I've found with many people, Unless you do have something like schizophrenia or, you know, a high anxiety disorder where there's something that's clearly known to calm it, the best therapy is actually cognitive therapy. I've been on many different drugs from antidepressants to mood stabilizers to try to balance out because I have bipolar, and none of them have truly worked. But most of the work that has happened, most of the stuff that's helped me functioning is just the stuff that I've learned, like coping mechanisms. But that is not taught as much when you go to places like the Pavilion. They say, you know, you go to group and they say, okay, so what can we do for coping? But they don't really emphasize it. What's emphasized is when your doctor comes around to every single patient. It's like, here, let's put you on 5 new drugs, you know? So just your thoughts on that. I find interesting. Hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Boy, again, another three great points. You know, you're right. I'm talking about primarily about the adult mental health system when I speak. This is what I know. Unfortunately, the children's mental health system, particularly in this state, has been decimated. There really is not a children's mental health system unless you are going to access it via another vehicle, such as through child welfare. The services are extremely limited. So yes, it is. And you can imagine, as the caller indicated, there is the added extra of often children are forced into mental health by their parents. And I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, being forced, but they are certainly compelled, right, is the case, whereas adults are not compelled that way. So it adds an interesting layer to the interaction and to the therapy. In terms of the medication, I think you hit it on the head. For some people, they do work, and clearly for you, they were less effective. But the cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been shown to be effective in a number of mental health disorders, was worked for you. And you're right, to access that and to get the sessions that you need that are effective in terms of their number and their quality is very difficult. And there was one other point. There was a third point there that I'm missing.
Yes,
about the very small subset of people that are violent.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you're right. The violence occurs across mental health disorders, and I would just hesitate and warn people in the public. It's a very small subset of people. The thing that's problematic about it is what the caller indicated. It's unpredictable what they're going to do. And that leaves all of us in a difficult situation, given that, A, it's a small group of people, and, B, what they're going to do is unpredictable.
I think that's a really important point, and I'm glad you came back to it. And I wanted to make a point of that as well, is that when you have a case like that of Virginia Tech, it focuses attention on one individual with severe psychological problems who committed violence. And I think that you have to point out the fact that the vast majority of people who have severe psychological problems are not going to be a danger to others. Primarily, they're probably a danger to themselves. It is probably more likely that they will do harm to themselves than that they would hurt somebody else. And the, you know, the kind of pain that they might be going through could be considerable. And they're the ones who are suffering, and it's other people don't have to deal with that suffering. It's their suffering.
It is, you know, and if you think about teenagers and the school shootings, right, Columbine, and some of the other schools, these are incidents that draw us out, and they really are so dramatic and so few and far between. I wish they would never existed, but the fact of the matter is, we're more the number of kids in high school who are cutting themselves because of mental health problems dwarfs the number of kids that are likely to turn violent. The numbers are outrageously large, and we see a growing number of kids turning to cutting and other self-destructive behaviors more often than outwardly.
We have another caller here. This is someone listening in Batavia. It's line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you today?
Good.
Good.
Interesting conversation. I tell you, I'm going through a bunch of stuff myself right now. I have a mom that has cancer and a dad that has cancer, and what they're doing is you know, taking all these drugs, and, you know, you're talking about mental health. And I think it's eventually it's going to affect every citizen in the country and in possibly in the world. And the reason I say this is when you get sick in your older ages, you know, your psyche gets, especially if you get told you have cancer or terminal cancer or something, you start thinking of things and you start getting depressed. And, you know, we're all talking about the kids and, you know, I think at one point in everybody's life, somebody's going to have some kind of mental problem. Now, I'm bringing this up because this guy that killed all these kids in Virginia Tech and, you know, Columbine and all this other thing, if you start regulating and giving people drugs because of, you know, whatever reason, you know, it might be for mental illness, everybody's different. Those same drugs won't affect, say, somebody else with the same problem. They'll affect them differently. I know this personally just from a few people I know that have a depression problem. When they were on the drugs, they were okay. When they got off the drugs, they just went nuts. And it actually was worse before they started, or after they started taking the drugs than before. The problem they tried to fix with the drugs didn't quite help, in other words. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that the drug companies in this country just want to sell drugs to people. They don't care about I personally think they don't really care all that much about fixing people's problems. Because every time I go to the doctor myself for an illness who wants to give me some drugs, it isn't trying to go to the source and figure out what the problem is and seeing if it's something, there's another way of doing it. And I personally don't like taking drugs. It makes me deathly ill no matter what it is. So I try to do the natural herbs and stuff. Not all the time I can. I'm fortunate to that point. But, you guys are bringing up a lot of good subjects, but still, to rely on drugs in general for anything, to me, is not, you're relying on somebody else to basically take care of your life. I don't know how. You see where I'm going on this?
Absolutely. I think, again, you know, we would be very hesitant. Yeah, think about this. If let's look at it. If you had cancer, you would never just go to the doctor and receive the drug portion of the cancer treatment and never interact with them and never talk to them and only receive that part of it. They're really, and we've seen that in fact, we see cancer centers growing to be, quote unquote, more holistic and attempting to take a holistic approach because that's what clients want. So the thought of treating mental health through a singular solution, and in particular a singular solution that is a drug, seems problematic in many, many cases to me.
Yeah. Well, here, I know I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're kind of getting down to the point where we're almost at the end. We're really keep coming around probably to the same point in a sense, and it seems like everybody recognizes it. Individuals recognize it. People who have come into the system recognize it. Social workers and psychologists recognize it. Everybody does, and that while we might have medications that can be helpful, we still seem to have a significant need for people, one-on-one interaction kind of stuff, for people who are having difficulties to be able to sit down with another person who is trained and experienced in this way and try to figure out, okay, what's going on with them? What's happening in your life? What are your challenges? What are your stresses? Can we teach you some ways to try to cope with this better? Is it useful for you to sit and try to think about, well, really what is going on and how do I react to stresses in my life? And, you know, what's the family history and all that kind of stuff? Not that that can go on for years, maybe, but that that kind of thing has to be a part of it. And unfortunately, that's going to be more labor intensive and more expensive than simply writing a prescription and say, okay, take one of these twice a day. So it still seems that it gets us back to the need for really old fashioned kind of one-on-one counseling.
Which is going to be very expensive, as you're sort of indicating. Although we have seen cost comparisons that it's not incredibly outrageously expensive, more expensive than doing medication. But it is going to require a lot more money than we currently put into the system. And really, that means we're going to have to be much more creative about thinking how to fund mental health services than looking to just the state and the federal government for that. You know, and I just quickly, I know we're running out of time here, David, just a couple of things that have been creative. Locally, we have a 708 board here. That is a county tax-based funded program that we as a community decided to put in place, and this is a creative approach. We've seen in Illinois, NAMI highlighted the fact that housing for mental illness is going to be funded in some way by the real estate transaction fees that are paid here in the state, and this is a very progressive look. And one other very progressive attempt at changing funding streams is out in California, where Proposition 63 sought to put a 1% surtax on people making over $1 million a year that would fund mental health services. And that looked at about 25 or 35,000 people in the state and was going to raise about $250 million. These are three very innovative ways to start to rethink about how do we fund mental health services, given that the traditional funding sources are not likely to step up to the plate anytime in the near future.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point that we're going to have to finish. There, if you're interested in exploring and thinking more about these issues, there certainly are various kinds of resources available through the internet if you have web access. One probably good place for people to go is this, the organization that you mentioned. You mentioned it by its initials. It's the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Yes.
They have a very good website, and I'm sure that there are others if people want to sort of explore the issues.
GROW is also, I would suggest, yeah, is an Illinois-based and is an excellent consumer-based organization, too.
All right. Our guest of this hour of Focus 580, Christopher Larson. He is assistant professor of social work here at the U of I, among other things, in his teaching and research. He's interested in mental health policy and services. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.